org if anybody wants to be in touch. I edit mediachannel.org and blog at newsdissector.net.
Well, Danny Schechter, you're full of information, and we're going to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
I hope so. Thank you.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank our guest, Danny Schechter, and I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott and our team, our engineered assistant producer. Thank you. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Please check out our website at www.soultrueradio.org and like and friend us on Facebook. If you are a member, look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bag and Baggage Productions presents The Tempest, performing from Thursday, August 11th through Sunday, August 28th in Hillsborough. This bilingual adaptation of William Shakespeare's The Tempest will be performed throughout various parks in Hillsborough. The Tempest is a story of love, redemption, forgiveness, and the nature of storytelling. That's Bag and Baggage Production presents The Tempest, performing from Thursday, August 11th through Sunday, August 28th in Hillsborough. More information can be found at kb.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Ahlan wa sahlan and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1021, our topic will be the latest Israeli attack on the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. I will air portions of an interview Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Conducted on August 8, 2022 with Issam Adwan, Gaza-based journalist, activist, and researcher, and also share with you the remarks of Issam Younis, director of Al Mizan Center for Human Rights in Gaza and head of the Independent Commission for Human Rights of Palestine, delivered at a special session of the United Nations Human Rights Council on the grave human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory. In addition, I will air the remarks delivered at the United Nations Security Council on August 8, 2022 by Dr. Riyad Mansour, Ambassador and Permanent Observer of Palestine to the United Nations. I will also share with you the remarks of Professor Rashid Khalidi delivered at the United Nations Security Council last year on the steps necessary to implement United Nations resolutions and provide peace and security for all in Palestine. The Gaza Strip, where over 2 million Palestinians live on about 140 square miles, one of the most densely populated areas on planet Earth, has been under siege and blockade for over 15 years, thanks to apartheid Israel. They suffered many wars that destroyed the Gaza Strip and killed thousands of Palestinians, including children, women, and elderly. As a matter of fact, Israel launched four wars on the Gaza Strip since 2008, killing nearly 4,000 Palestinians, including about 1,000 children. At least 130 Palestinians have been killed by apartheid Israel since the beginning of 2022 so far. Of course, apartheid Israel, the settler colonial state, needed to continue its terrorism and killing spree. That's what it got used to do, because there is no one out there to hold it accountable or stop it. On August 5, 2022, it launched an unprovoked yet another attack on the Gaza Strip that lasted 3 days, killing 46 Palestinians, including 16 children, and wounding hundreds others. They destroyed many, many buildings. Hundreds of residential homes are unlivable. The children they killed include Jamil, 4 years old, Ala, 5 years old, Mu'min, 5 years old, Hazim, 9 years old, Ahmed, 11 years old, Jamil, 13 years old, Muhammad, 13 years old, Dahlia, 13 years old, Muhammad, 14 years old, Hamid, 16 years old, Nazmi, 16 years old, Ahmed, 16 years old, Muhammad, 17 years old, and Khalil, 18 years old. A ceasefire agreement was reached between apartheid Israel and the Palestinian resistance fighters in the Gaza Strip, so apartheid Israel couldn't just be sitting around without executing its plan of ethnically cleansing Palestine. So on August 9, 2022, it attacked Nablus City in the occupied West Bank, murdered 3 Palestinians, and injured dozens more. Another Palestinian, 17-year-old Mu'min Jaber, was killed in Hebron by Israel, and nearly 100 others were injured in various areas throughout the West Bank and occupied Jerusalem. Israel also, over the past few days, demolished several Palestinian homes, which is almost a daily occurrence, again, as part of its Zionist plan to ethnically cleanse Palestine. And it also announced it will expand its colonies on occupied Palestine by building more housing for Jews only on stolen Palestinian land. Israel is doing all of that because it has full impunity from the world for whatever war crimes it commits. The Zionist settler colonial project in Palestine continues, supported and funded mainly by the United States and the United Kingdom. For today's program, I had made arrangements to record an interview with a distinguished guest in Gaza, and as I started to record that interview, They lost power in the Gaza Strip, so we couldn't finish that interview and secure it for today's program. So I'm going to share with you portions of an interview Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Conducted on August 8, 2022 with Assam Adwan, Gaza-based journalist, activist, and researcher. Let's listen in.
For more, we go to Gaza now to speak with Assam Adwan, Palestinian journalist, activist, researcher, and new father. Assam, welcome back to Democracy Now! This ceasefire has been declared between Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Israel. Can you talk about what has happened over the weekend?
Thank you for hosting me. The scene is, as usually, terrifying for me as a new father of a two-month infant. As a journalist on the other part, that we are expecting everything from the Israeli side, even during the times of the ceasefire, because several instances before indicated the violation of the times of the ceasefire. The situation is horrifying. We have witnessed 44 Palestinians dying, including 15 children and 6 women, which represents half of the casualties from the Palestinian side. There are no words to describe the war crimes that have been committed, even with the claims of the Israeli authority that they are targeting PIJ's senior members, military senior members. This included, of course, targeting of residential buildings, killing children and women, of course.
Can you talk about what started this?
So what started, just to correct you a little bit in your introduction, that you mentioned that Israel cut fuel supplies to Gaza during the bombardment launched on Gaza of the operation, of course. But it happened four days before the escalation started, when the Israeli administration decided to close both borders, Kerem Shalom crossing and Eretz crossing, which they are the main crossings of the goods that enters into Gaza, as well as the medical equipment and fuel as well. So when they decided to do that, it came along with a provocative action to detain Bassam Saadi, a senior member of the PIJs in the West Bank. Of course, with no response by the political parties here in Gaza, they have added more violence with the targeting of Taysir al-Jabri, a senior member of the PIJs in Gaza. Just to give you a sense of understanding about Taysir al-Jabri, he had been more of a political person rather than being a military.
Can you talk about the two Palestinian Islamic Jihad leaders who were killed and Israel's assertion that this was a preemptive attack on a possible attack against Israel?
I don't know how to describe this properly, but what a preemptive attacks when included that the international laws, especially the international humanitarian laws, which prohibit targeting buildings and areas which contains hundreds of civilians. We're talking about Gaza, that is about 365 square kilometers, where 2 million of people are put with an intentional policy to suffocate every norms of their existence. So how you can possibly target senior members of the PIJs, and as I stated before, they were more of political persons rather than being military. So significantly saying that they were not of a great threat to the Israeli administration, but following what has been happening inside, I mean, the dispute happening inside the Israeli administration ahead of the pre-elections coming in the future, that they are using the Palestinian blood to promote a campaign for certain individuals, especially with the decreasing of the public support provided to Lapid and Gantz in particular during the run of the current government.
Talk about the Israeli elections coming up in November and how you feel they weigh in here.
It's actually the same. No matter who runs the Israeli government, it's always the same, with the same policy to suffocate the Gaza Strip. We're talking about 15 years of blockade. This blockade killed every existence of people living in Gaza. And there were several individuals running the Israeli government of different opinions and different views and different policies to deal with Gaza. But all the policies were met on a one goal, that the Palestinians in Gaza do not deserve to live a normal life. This extent leads us to think that this change inside the Israeli government is just a minor change, just an apparent change of who's leading the government, but the policy remains the same, either being a right wing or a left wing of Israelis.
Now talk about the situation in Gaza. What does it mean to have the blackout and the number of casualties? What's the latest figure? We heard 44, more than a third of them children, over 300 people injured. What's happening in the hospitals and how do you get these figures?
Yes, with the, as I mentioned, as I highlighted before, that the Israeli administration decided implemented the closure of the Gaza Strip 4 days ahead of the operation starts in Gaza, including a shortage, including blocking the entrance of fuel, which is Gaza mainly depends to run 8 hours a day in the normal cases. With the shortage of the fuel, of course, it hugely influenced the capacity of the hospitals to treat those injuries and also to put those dead people in the proper places. This is an indicator of a harsh policy that the Israeli administration has been dealing with Gaza. And I don't know how to describe this in a human side level, because even to me personally, I have experienced because the media mainly focusing on Gaza whenever there are hundreds of people dying, hundreds of houses bombed. But there are other times during these 15 years of blockade, people are dying because of the poverty, people are dying because of the lack of hope, lack of job opportunities. And that is what the media is neglecting to cover on the situation of Gaza.
Israel and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad agreed to a Cairo-mediated truce after 3 days of intense rocket attacks by Israeli forces.
Now for sure we have reached a deal, and there is an Egyptian commitment to release the prisoners, Khalil Awada and Bassam Asadi, as soon as possible from the Israeli jails. We announced ceasefire by 11:30, and we welcome the Egyptian efforts that were made to end this battle.
That's an Islamic Jihad spokesperson, Issam Adwan. Can you talk about Egypt's involvement here and where you think this is going at this point?
Yeah. As I said before, the ceasefire is never a safe solution for the people of Gaza, because it moves no tangible improvements on the situation of Gaza, of day by day and from a war to war, especially the wars of 2008, 12, 14, and 2021, and this current one. The infrastructure of Gaza is hugely damaged. The medical expertise and equipment are barely found. So the solution and the ceasefire that happened between BIJs and the Israeli side, there were three conditions revealed from the Egyptian mediation, who has been positively in the process, that first to release Sheikh Bassam Saadi, who was detained by the Israeli government in the previous days heading of the escalation, and releasing the Palestinian prisoner Khalil Awad, who has been in a hunger strike for more than 100 days with an intentional medical negligence, to transfer him to medical care systems. Those demands, they are indications of how much the situation is worsening day by day. And that's why the situation is not improving, and people do not feel safety, because Israel can determine a new round of escalation throughout assassinating a valuable target, as they claim, despite the fact that even the Israeli media outlets, they do not recognize this as a big of achievement, the killing, and I mean by that, the killing of Mansour and Taysir al-Jabari. As I said before, they were more of a political targets rather than being a military, so there is no significant achievement recognized, but the Israeli government keeps bragging about it.
Israel is saying that a number of the Palestinians killed were killed by the backfiring of Palestinian Islamic Jihad's own missiles. Your response, Issam Adwan?
I believe the Israeli side used a video, an anonymous video that shows nothing in the middle of the darkness. That during the bombardment of Jabalia refugee camp, said there were no, I would say, clear indications that this is by the BIJ's misfired rocket. We have seen a huge bombardment launched on Gaza during the times between 9 p.m. to 12 p.m. During these times, more than 12 targets were hit on Jabalia camp, so there were no clear identification of whether this. But let's take into consideration the explosive power. The Israeli side has always undermined the potential, the rocket's potential of the Palestinian resistance. And now they are recognizing that this rocket could kill seven Palestinians. I don't think this makes any sense, because Israel exaggerates whenever the exaggeration in its benefits, and they undermine the potential of the Palestinians whenever they see it fit.
You tweeted, "The ceasefire is never a time to celebrate for Gazans, but rather a moment to mourn the deaths of innocent civilians killed by the Israeli warplane, to barely survive wondering, am I going to be next?" Can we end where we started? You're a new father. You have a two-month-old little girl named Sarah. Can you talk about what you see the future as in Gaza?
It's really terrifying. During thinking about it all the years, even before Sarah came to my life, that I have a huge sense of guilt that I brought her into life. It's really pessimist to talk about it, but inside of me, it eats me alive that I brought a child into a situation that never rested. I was born in 1993. Lived my entire life under the direct occupation, and for the past 15 years, I have been denied the majority of my rights, including the right to have a proper education outside, or medication in cases of illness. So imagining the situation applies to my daughter Sarah is terrifying me the most, because being a journalist and being hugely exposed to cases of slaughtering children and women, it keeps echoing in my mind, it keeps echoing in my heart, and it eats me from inside that, is it going to be next? And if it's not me, it could be my Sarah.
That was an interview, Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, conducted on August 8, 2022, with Assam Adwan, Gaza-based journalist, activist, and researcher. Assam Yunus, director for Al Mizan Center for Human Rights in Gaza and head of the Independent Commission for Human Rights of Palestine, spoke last year at a special session of the United Nations Human Rights Council on the grave human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, a situation that continues to deteriorate to this day. By the way, during the 2014 Israeli war on Gaza, Israel killed Assam Yunus' father, stepmother, and his four-year-old niece. Let's listen in to his remarks.
I'm Assam Yunus. Today, I'm speaking to you with my capacity as the Commissioner General of the Palestinian Independent Commission for Human Rights. I'm also the Director General of the Gaza-based Al Mizan Center for Human Rights. I'm also Palestinian, born and raised in Rafah, and now live in Gaza City with my family. We are again gathered for special session of the Council, because as member states, you have a choice. You have a choice to make, because of both recent and long-standing event occurring in Israel and Palestine. You have a choice to make because of the systematic impunity your government grant to Israel. You have a choice because Israel, with its firm control over Palestinians in the OPT, and Israel, with its vast military power and technology, and with the support of leading countries, decided to use its power to deliberately attack civilians, to attack and kill indefensible children within the sanctity of their homes. Between the 10th and 21st of May in Gaza, the Israeli military killed 253 Palestinians, including 66 children, many of them in their homes while they slept without warning. The subject is particularly raw of me because it was in Israel's 2014 assault that one night, while my father, my stepmother, and my four-year-old niece slept in their beds, the Israeli military bombarded their neighborhood and killed them in their sleep. All over Gaza, for 11 days, entire families were huddled in hallways and living on kitchen floors, because those seemed like the safest places. But nowhere is safe in Gaza. The Israeli military destroyed 1,800 homes and damaged upwards of 14,000 more. When many families and I received the warning to evacuate last week, we were lucky to have a relative's home to share. On the nearly 60,000 people who were made homeless, many are living in appalling humanitarian conditions in makeshift shelters. Israel's unlawful closure, 14-year collective punishment, was tightened heightened its devastating impact on social, economic, cultural, and environmental rights for 2 million people. This May, Israel destroyed 23 hospitals and medical, partially and totally. The only sewage plant was made inoperable. The 12-story tower that housed Al Jazeera and the AP was brought to the ground, which meant that getting information out was made ever more difficult. Israel chose to use its power to escalate on all fronts. First, with its continued attempts to ethnically cleanse Palestinians in Jerusalem and then across the OPT and Israel. With excessive force, mass arbitrary arrests and state-sanctioned mob violence. Right now, the Israeli authorities are again escalating with an arrest campaign in Jerusalem and of Palestinian citizens in Israel. But these recent events are only a symptom. The problem is that for 73 years, the Palestinian people have endured systematic, institutionalized, and long-established laws, policies, and practices that aim to impose and maintain the settler colonial regime of racial domination and oppression over Palestinians on both sides of the Green Line. If you read recent reports by international and regional organizations, you know that this apartheid regime encompasses not just Palestinians in the OPT, but also of those of us in Israel and those of us as refugees and in exile abroad. Israel's forced inequality is sanctioned and supported by states in this council, which should uphold our collective values of fairness, justice, security, and equality. In applying the rule of law, the Palestinian people should not be an exception. And so today, you have a choice, either to vote in favor of the resolution before you, to move us forward under the shelter of international law, or to withhold your support and choose geographical and economic interest. Please listen to the speakers today, in particular to the people impacted on the ground with an ear tuned to international law and the principles of this council. Thank you.
That was Issam Younis, director for Al Mizan Center for Human Rights in Gaza and the head of the Independent Commission for Human Rights of Palestine, speaking at the Human Rights Council last year. You're listening to Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. The United Nations Security Council held an emergency meeting on August 8, 2022, to discuss the latest attack on the besieged Gaza Strip by apartheid Israel. And I'm going to air now the remarks delivered at that meeting by Dr. Riyad Mansour, ambassador and permanent observer of Palestine to the United Nations.
Mr. President, Israel claims for itself a right to security that would seemingly justify murdering, imprisoning, and oppressing an entire nation. It claims a right to security that would trump our right to life, our right to self-determination, our right to be safe in our homes. It claims a right to security that supersedes the UN Charter, international humanitarian law, and human rights law. It claims for itself everything that it denies us. Israel claims it is always defending itself, even when it keeps attacking the Palestinian people. If you are against violence, do not excuse Israeli violence. Do not justify it. Do not encourage it. Israelis' so-called, quote-unquote, right to security has become a license to kill, and it must be revoked. In an international law-based order, international law is the measuring stick for anybody's actions. We are bound by its rules and remain ready to abide by them. What about the other party? Can it keep rewriting the rules as it wishes? And can you accept such double standards that undermine the protection of the law everywhere? How many more times will Israel get to justify bombing our people in Gaza until someone says enough is enough? Are you ready to say enough is enough? As the highest authority responsible for the maintenance of international peace and security, how many more years does it get to impose its inhumane blockade on 2 million people, half of them children, until someone says enough is enough? How many more children do we have to bury until someone says enough is enough? Regardless of who is in power in Israel, there are two constant features of Israeli policy: bombing Gaza and advancing colonial settlements and the settlers' agenda. These are undeniable facts. While Israel was bombing Gaza this time around, Israeli extremists were storming yet again Al-Haram al-Sharif and violating the historic status. This was an unprovoked and unjustified aggression. Its real reason is barely veiled: the upcoming Israeli election and the desperation to appeal to and appease the extremists. 44, and Mr. Tor Wensland told us it's 46, and they're counting, Palestinians killed. 15 children in a morbid power play and display. Israel kills our people because it can. When will the world show them that they cannot? Mr. President, doesn't this council have a clear position on protection of civilians? Are our civilians' lives less worthy of protection than other civilians? Are they somehow the exception to every rule? Are they in a zone where the UN Charter and international law do not apply? Or is the identity of their aggressor somehow enough to justify blanket immunity for the perpetrators and no protection for the victims? The Secretary General's recommendations presented 4 years ago and welcomed by the General Assembly have yet to be implemented. And here I'm referring to protections. We need protection. Our civilians are entitled to protection. Our children deserve protection. Alaa Qaddoum was 5 years old, and I'm sure that all of you have seen her picture. Innocent angel. Do you know how hard it is to speak in the past tense of those who are yet to experience life? Alaa Qaddoum was 5 years old, and she was already 3 wars old. She survived the first two, not the third one. Did you hear about the parents who spent years trying to have a child and finally had a son, only to have to bury him a few years later? Did you hear about an-Nabahin family, another name added to the long list of Palestinian families who lost 4 or more of their members, including 3 children? Do you know how it feels to be powerless, to be unable to provide any protection to your child, to know there is no safe haven anywhere, no shelter anywhere, to survive one war and wait for the next one onslaught? How can I convey these things so people finally understand that those who really need your support to their security are these defenseless Palestinian families, not the nuclear power, not the occupying power? How will Israel answer our calls for protection? By blaming the victim. Israel beyond reproach. It kills Palestinians because it has to, and it always has to. If it is stealing our land, it is our fault. If it is killing our children, it is our fault. If it is occupying our country, it is our fault. If it is besieging our people, it is our fault. Israel wants peace. That is why it builds Israeli settlements and demolishes Palestinian homes. Israel wants peace, and that is why it needs to expand, and we need to live in enclaves. When do we say enough is enough? Should we wait for the next round or the one after? The next aggression, the next settlement, the next forced transfer of civilians? When do we finally demonstrate to the Palestinian people that there is a peaceful path that leads to freedom, instead of doing everything to convince them otherwise? Mr. President, a 15-year-old child in Gaza has survived a blockade that is older than he or she is, and 6 wars. How many more wars does he or she need to survive before acceding to life, a simple and safe life in their homeland? The Secretary General stated in his report on children and armed conflict, and I quote, "I am shocked by the number of children killed and maimed by Israeli forces during hostilities, in airstrikes, in densely populated areas, and through the use of live ammunition, and by the persistent lack of accountability for these violations." End of quotation. Only weeks after the report was issued, we are confronted with the same patterns of disregard for Palestinian civilian life, and specifically Palestinian children's life, fostered by the same impunity. The Secretary General further stated, and I quote, "During the May 2021 escalation of hostilities, there were substantial airstrikes by the Israeli armed forces, resulting in a significant increase in the number of cases of violence against children. Should the situation repeat itself in 2022, without meaningful improvement, Israel should be listed." End of quotation. We believe the listing of Israel is long overdue, and that the threshold set by the Secretary General himself has yet again been crossed. Tor Wensland explained to us a similar situation in a condensed period of time, 3 days, in which 1/3 of the deaths were children. Mr. President, we express our deep gratitude to Egypt for its relentless efforts to put an end to this aggression. We also express our appreciation to the UN and the Special Representative of the Secretary General, and to Qatar, and to all those who helped in this violent, abhorrent aggression. But this situation is profoundly unsustainable. Where do we go from here? We know the result of the current equation. Us Palestinians more than anybody else. But another equation is possible. Your actions need to be determined by the outcome you are seeking. The international community and this council have determined in no uncertain terms the outcome we aspire to. We have a global consensus on what the solution should look like, an outcome embedded in countless UN resolutions, including those adopted by this council. You are not bystanders praying for that outcome. You are actors who can decisively affect the outcome. You are the highest authority in the UN system for the maintenance of international peace and security. You are not an organization that make comments and express opinions. You are the body that can change things, enforce things, and decide that things should be done according to international law and to your collective will reflected in your resolutions. 15 children were killed in a few days, and many more are traumatized and suffering. They deserve a better future, a future you can help bring into being. This meeting is for honoring them. They deserve to be honored. Every child killed, innocent child, anywhere, deserve to be honored. In 3 days, we lost 15 children. During his visit, President Biden reiterated that Palestinians and Israelis deserve equal measures of freedom, security, and prosperity. He certainly did not mean by that the Israelis should enjoy the abysmal level of freedom, security, and prosperity that the Palestinians are currently living under. We deserve the same. These words should be applicable to us, implemented regarding us, enforced regarding us, not only regarding the Israeli side alone. Gaza's fate is not to go from rubbles to rubbles, nor is Palestine's fate to remain under occupation. The Palestinian people's fate is to live in freedom, dignity, and security in their homeland. We need to shape collectively a political horizon that can take us away from the current reality and break the impasse we are in. The Secretary General, in his statement yesterday, emphasized that point. All of you talk about political horizon. We need to move from saying that to implementing that. We should not wait until the next war or the next election. Peace is never reached by waiting. You need to seek it out with all your strength and determination and the power that you have under the provisions of the Charter. You are very powerful. You can make it. You can enforce it. And we want you to do that. Act now. Save lives. Save peace. Whatever the price, peace must be achieved, as the cost of war will always be infinitely higher. We know our people are the ones enduring most of that cost. Peace is within reach if the will of those seeking peace proves stronger than the will of those denying it. We appeal to you. Our president always say that not only one hand, both of my hands are extended to you for peace. Do we have undertakers from the other side? You should make it as a Security Council enforceable, and you should not accept that until one party to decide that it is ready for peace. You decide when peace should be the case, and you should drag the two parties to the process of peace today before tomorrow. This is our message to you, the message of the victims, the message who speak on behalf of the 15 children that we lost, that we are honoring them today in this session of the Security Council. And I thank you very much, Mr. President.
That was Dr. Riyad Mansour, Ambassador and Permanent Observer of Palestine to the United Nations, speaking at the United Nations Security Council on August 8, 2022. By the way, we've had him on this program a few times over the years. And speaking of the United Nations and what can be done, Professor Rashid Khalidi briefed the Security Council last year on the steps necessary to implement United Nations resolutions and provide peace and security for all in Palestine. Professor Rashid Khalidi, whom we've also had live on this program before, is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University in New York. He is editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies and author of many books, including The 100 Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. Let's listen in to his remarks at the United Nations Security Council.
Mr. President, distinguished members of the Security Council, I'm deeply grateful to the Council and to the Chinese Presidency for the opportunity to brief you, particularly at what may be a new juncture in the evolution of the question of Palestine. Palestinians, wherever they are, in occupied Arab East Jerusalem, where the latest round of violence started a few weeks ago, in the occupied West Bank, in besieged Gaza, inside Israel, and in the vast Palestinian diaspora, all of them have responded to the events of the past several weeks with an unprecedented degree of unity. These events and this show of unity have provoked a worldwide recognition of the realities on the ground, realities of systemic discrimination, of oppression, and of settler colonialism that can no longer be brushed aside and hidden by stale clichés. Young people and people of conscience the world over have responded to the images that emerged from different parts of Palestine and that were diffused especially by social media, but also by the mainstream media. Public discourse has begun to shift in consequence. On June 9th, 1967, at the height of the June 1967 war, as a college student, I sat in the visitors' gallery of this very chamber where you are sitting, watching as a permanent member ensured the impunity which allowed a member state to ignore Security Council ceasefire resolutions and continue its military offensive for another 24 hours. This action nearly 54 years ago exacerbated problems that this body is still wrestling with. The same pattern of guaranteeing impunity for violations of international law and Security Council resolutions has recurred repeatedly since then. Most recently during this council's deliberation on events in Palestine earlier this month. As you all know, since the founding of the United Nations, the Security Council has passed multiple resolutions on the Palestine problem and the Arab-Israeli conflict. These issues have taken up more of the time and energy of your body than any other global issue. Most of these resolutions have not been implemented or respected. In effect, they are dead letters. This systemic disrespect for Security Council resolutions, encouraged by the impunity I have described, has left this Council and the United Nations itself, I am sad to say, in justifiable disrepute. Most seriously, this impunity has been a major obstacle to establishing peace, justice, and security for all who live in Palestine and Israel. I've not been asked to brief on the failings of the past, however. Instead, I hope to offer suggestions based on my understanding of the history of this issue to reinforce the efforts of this body to achieve lasting peace and security in Palestine and Israel in the future. It is clear to me, and I hope it is clear to you, that whatever their merits, a number of important palliatives currently under consideration are not by themselves going to produce a lasting solution for the problems of Palestine and Israel. They include rebuilding the degraded infrastructure of Gaza with no guarantee that it will not be destroyed for a fifth time. They include stressing quality of life for Palestinians without providing them with a clear and fixed political horizon. They include, finally, yet again, launching a meaningless peace process that is structured by the most powerful actors to avoid all of the difficult core issues central to achieving a sustainable resolution of this issue. Any effort to achieve real peace and security must belatedly grapple with these painful core issues that go back to the first efforts of the General Assembly and this Council to deal with the question of Palestine in the earliest years after the establishment of the United Nations. What are these core issues? They are the dispossession of the Palestinian people starting in 1948. They are the status of Jerusalem. They are the supposedly temporary military occupation that has endured since 1967. And they are ensuring that any projected solution is grounded in international law and in the resolutions of this Council and is not based on whatever happens to be convenient for the most powerful actors involved in this issue. I am a historian of the Middle East and a longtime observer of the proceedings of this Council. My father worked in the Security Council for nearly two decades as a member of the UN Secretariat. I understand perfectly that power relations structure what is possible and what is impossible. I understand perfectly how difficult it is to make national agendas coincide such that collective action becomes possible. However, if there were a moment to transcend these restraints and for collective action to address a source of suffering that has endured for the better part of a century, this is it. The most recent upheaval in Palestine and Israel has sharpened contradictions, has aroused new passions, some of them ugly, and has awakened consciences. It has also pricked the bubble of cherished illusions, such as the illusion that no one in the Arab world or globally cares about Palestine. The solidarity marches, the social media explosion, the unprecedented nature of mainstream media coverage of recent events, the unprecedented wave of solidarity with Palestinians the world over, all of these phenomena together show that however much some might wish that this were not the case, Palestine is important and cannot be ignored. They also show that the Palestinians will not give up their struggle to achieve their inalienable rights. A problem that many for decades have hoped would disappear has reappeared in an even more intense and troubling form. This is therefore time to call a spade, and to abandon the cruel false equivalence that ignores casualty ratios of from 4 or 10 or 20 to 1, that places the occupier on the same footing as the occupied, and that puts a nuclear-armed regional superpower on the same footing as a people that has never been allowed to enjoy self-determination. If this false equivalence is maintained, if the lopsided balance of power between the two peoples is allowed to dictate outcomes, there will never be an end to this bloodletting and oppression, and the Security Council will continue to issue empty resolutions with no force for the rest of the 21st century, as it has done for many of the past decades. Mr. President, Excellencies, how can the impunity which enormous power grants to one side be overcome? What are needed, in my view, are both small steps and big steps. Small steps can include this body urgently demanding, not requesting from the blockading powers, but demanding under penalty of sanctions that the humanitarian and medical and dietary and other basic needs of the people of Gaza be freed of cruel political considerations and that the collective punishment of 2 million people be ended. Surely this small step is within the power of the Security Council. I think all can see how doing this, which requires forceful action, would ameliorate the situation in Palestine. Small steps include the Security Council working to help cement the unity of the Palestinian people on a democratic basis, a unity that the colonial power has worked ceaselessly to undermine. This could include United Nations mandated and supervised elections that can be obstructed neither by the occupying power nor by outside powers that cultivate proxies and meddle in Palestinian affairs. Small steps might include the demand that the status quo regarding the holy sites in Jerusalem, a status quo that has been systematically infringed upon be strictly respected by all. This status quo goes back not only to the many UN resolutions on Jerusalem or to the British Mandate period. It is rooted in the era of Ottoman rule. It was hammered out over many decades of war and diplomacy. As we have seen in recent weeks, it is playing with fire, an unholy fire, to allow this status quo to be trampled upon, as has been happening for all too many decades, both in the period of Jordanian rule of the eastern part of the city, and especially since the Israeli occupation and annexation of 1967. Larger steps might include should include reiterating forcefully the basic building blocks of the international order as far as Palestine is concerned, as these have been laid down in Security Council and other UN resolutions. These include the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force, central principle of resolution passed by this body in November 67, the illegality of the colonization of occupied territory by the occupier citizens, as laid out in the Fourth Geneva Convention, the right of refugees to return and to compensation, as laid out in UN General Assembly Resolution 181, and the necessity of an international role in resolving the question of Jerusalem, as has been laid out in repeated Security Council resolutions. For the Council simply to reiterate clearly and explicitly that these building blocks, rooted all of them in international law and in UN resolutions, are the only possible basis of a just and lasting solution would ameliorate the situation immeasurably. I understand how difficult it may be to achieve unanimity today, even on these points, every single one of which has been voted for unanimously or nearly unanimously by this council or other UN bodies in the past, but this is crucially important, simply reiterating them. Another larger step would be for the council to assert its prerogatives and push forcefully for a more multilateral and less unilateral structure for resolution of the Palestine question. The unilateral approach, which has prevailed since the Gunnar Jarring mission, which was eclipsed towards the end of the 1960s, a half century ago, has manifestly failed to bring peace to Palestine or to Israel. And it is time for it to be replaced by more multilateral and less biased efforts. I understand that power has its prerogatives and cannot be ignored, but it is time to realize that a century of unmitigated failure should bring this body to search for a better, a more multilateral way to structure a negotiation than the unilateral one that has been followed with no success until now. A much bigger step, albeit one that should not be so hard for this body to adopt or for the world community to accept, is the principle that in any projected solution in Palestine, Israel, all citizens of both the Palestinian and Israeli peoples and both collectivities must enjoy rights and security on a basis of complete equality. Whatever rights one enjoys, the other must enjoy as well. These rights include the right of self-determination and political, civil, human, and religious rights. This is not such a far-fetched notion. In November 1947, the UN General Assembly voted for the creation of two states in Palestine. One was eventually established, one was not. For all its many flaws and the injustice to the overwhelming Arab majority of the Palestinian population that it embodied at that time, this resolution contained one kernel that we can look back on and build on. This is the indisputable principle that two peoples live in Palestine, Israel. In whatever way these two peoples are to structure their relations in the future, whether on a two-state or on some other basis, the weaker cannot be left to the mercies of the stronger, with its powerful ally putting its thumb on the already tilted scales. This is where the Security Council can and must play a role by insisting that the principle of complete equality of rights and international law be the essential basis of any lasting solution. Mr. President, I know a little bit of the difficulties that your excellencies and the states you represent must confront in dealing with this intractable issue. I understand that it is an issue that has profound resonance within the internal politics of your countries, and that it is an issue that provokes intense passions on all sides. Nevertheless, this is the moment to grasp that sharp nettle, to bring concepts of right, principle, justice, and equality to bear in order to overcome the decades of expediency that have given the hollow shell of a process, but have manifestly not brought peace to Palestine or to the two peoples who live there. As I have recently written, rather than bringing peace, the efforts of the United Nations and outside parties in Palestine have all too often failed to prevent further displacement, further misery, further war. May the opportunity presented by the most recent crisis in Palestine and Israel lead this council to efforts that will break this pattern and set the two peoples on the path towards a just, lasting, and sustainable peace and real, equal security. Thank you very much.
What you just heard was a briefing delivered by Professor Rashid Khalidi at the United Nations Security Council last year on the steps necessary to implement United Nations resolutions and provide peace and security for all in Palestine. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.